From KHOI in Story City, Ames, I'm Chris Viviora, and this is Book Central, the show that interviews authors published in the Central Time Zone. My guest today on Book Central is Dustin M. Hoffman, debut author of 100 Knuckled Fist, a collection of working-class fiction, and the winner of the Prairie Schooner Book Prize published by University of Nebraska Press. Dustin's short stories make those who work with their hands visible. Dustin painted houses in Michigan for 10 years, and now he is an assistant professor of English at Winthrop University in South Carolina. Dustin M. Hoffman, welcome to Book Central.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
What do you do is one of the first questions someone asks when they're getting to know you. We spend the most amount of time on the job. Work shapes our identities. When I worked as an assistant to a carpenter, I remember him saying that anyone could paint. Well, actually, he said something worse, that contractors who don't know how to do other stuff paint. Dustin, in your short story, Sawdust and Glue, a father and son work as smiley carpentry, and the son tells a painter named Big Dave that his job is easier than ours. I guess this trash talk is something carpenters do to painters, but do you remember someone not recognizing your work as a painter, as a writer?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I think this was very common among the trades altogether. It was often everybody feeling like they were doing the toughest job working on a house. And maybe the painters took a little more of this than others, since we often got to work inside. And especially doing touch-up work, you get the carpet under your feet and the air conditioner and all this nice, fluffy, comfortable work. Of course, we thought that, you know, we were fixing the mistakes of the drywallers and the carpenters, and so we could talk plenty about how we made them look good. Mm. So, yeah, this is a constant back and forth. And, you know, it might stem from altogether tradesmen, you know, the ultimate goal is no one ever knowing that you were there in a house. And so I don't know. It might stem from that a little bit, all of us kind of lacking the recognition that I think many of them deserved, these amazing tradesmen. And it was the greatest no-no of all time. You never tell anybody your job is harder than anyone else's. I think that translates into teaching and certainly into writing. It's a theme throughout the entire book. I think characters seeking recognition, and it's one I felt as an artist and as a painter, you know, wanting to be accepted into this world, wanting to be told you're good at what you do. And I guess what job has any of us worked that this doesn't speak to us?
It's that whole idea of everyone can swing a brush so they think that they can paint, just like everyone can write so they think they can write a story. It's almost like writers who write look down on other writers. You know, a novelist might say to a poet, oh, you know, it's just a poem, but that's a pretty big no-no as well.
Oh, oh yeah, for sure. As I often tell my students, and I think this is very true, anyone can become a writer on their own, but what we do in classes is make you a writer faster with training and with apprenticeship. But I think of often the job that homeowners will try to do on their own is the painting. Mm. And it never bothered us. There's plenty of job security without that. But, you know, it's very obvious a homeowner paint job. You just look to the ceiling and look at that wavy line, and you look at the holidays and their roller marks. All of it's pretty obvious to us pretty quickly. But I think, you know, on the surface, it looks like this is an easy thing to do, like with writing. Sure, I have an idea for a story, but then the sentences become very obvious, you know, like the brush strokes, those small details. Which, by the way, the tip I always gave to the homeowner who wanted to do it themselves was don't use blue tape. Just buy a really expensive brush and take your time.
Huh. All right. Well, I always use the blue tape. You'd be able to tell. You know, I mean, maybe a homeowner's house would be a purgatory where you have to correct their mistakes. But also in Sawdust and Glue, the narrator says that hell is a hallway of trim that never ends. Did you have a hell when working as a painter? Do you now have a new hell as a professor?
As a professor, I suppose it is that endless stack of freshman comp papers full of, comma splices and dangling modifiers that I will be forever correcting and circling. So I think with painting, it was certainly those moments where it felt like the walls would never end in those 12, 14 hour days. I painted apartment complexes my first 2-3 years of painting houses, and that really gave me that endless feel of things that, you know, you're painting dozens of apartments a day, and it seemed like it would never come to a conclusion. So I think that was the hell of painting. You get that instant gratification of cleaning up a wall, and it looks beautiful when you're done, and then you turn, you go through the next door, and they're just, it's the same thing over and over again. It was good training, I think, as a writer, too. It's constant, redundant toiling over the same kind of struggles and problems to get it right. At least with writing, though, there are new challenges.
And conversely, I'd like to ask you about your heaven, or maybe not exactly your heaven, but about escape. One way of escaping physical work is to daydream, to leave by way of this mental trapdoor into imagination. In Can Picking, another one of your stories, a group of guys rove through an emptying stadium for empty aluminum cans to collect for deposit. And one man's child named Baby Trudy once dove into a fountain for coins and perhaps dreamed herself away, diving into a rich man's swimming pool. Did you ever imagine painting as something else, like up in the crow's nest of a ship or something? Or where did you go to escape into your mind?
Yeah, I can't think of a specific daydream necessarily, but I'm sure I was constantly somewhere else. I would have to be, to be able to survive that. I think many of us are often in our heads somewhere else. For me, that using my hands, that kind of the droning work of painting was a great place to write. I was constantly rolling the wall or pushing this brush and revising a sentence again and again, or thinking about this character, running them through my head. And I'd get home from painting and be so excited to get to the computer and put together all this stuff I've been working on in my head, or jotted down on like scraps of, drywall mud boxes. And now it's a little bit different. I'm kind of in a heavenly space in some ways. You know, I'm not working with my hands anymore, not struggling with my body. I get to teach and write, and it's a wonderful luxury. At the same time, you know, teaching and grading student work it feeds from that same mental energy that I use to write a story. So I no longer have this escape that I really valued of doing the manual labor and being able to think about my stories and revise. So I suppose, you know, heaven or hell, either way, you know, there's a flip side to it.
And I've been asking you a bit about heaven and hell because I started to consider a couple of your stories in 100 Knuckled Fist as parables. In the title story, this group of guys, former specialists and union members, finish the odds and ends of putting a house together. There's this slab of granite that costs more than they would earn that day, maybe all of them would earn that day, and it's broken on an outed man, a gay man. And I could hear the echo of Jesus calling in the Gospel of John, "Whichever one of you has committed no sin may throw the first stone." But in your story, the slab gets thrown, and the guy who did it must face the consequences. Would you consider your stories narratives extended parables, or maybe something else entirely?
I love your reading of that story, and very naively, I never even thought of the biblical allusion there. But of course, I mean, it's all about stone throwing and early judgments and prejudices, so I think that fits in a way, but it was an unintended parable, at least in that situation. And I think, you know, I'm always careful. I always try to come at a story without having a message to put into the piece.
Yeah, you don't want to moralize.
Yeah, yeah. But at the same time, I've always written from a sense of duty, I think, to get these working characters, to show them in all the grittiness and flawed reality that exists in these worlds, but also to find dignity and humanity and kind of these secret, unexpected wisdoms that exist in this world. So, you know, getting these stories right, getting it authentic and human is the most important thing to me. And, you know, out of that, of course, eventually you find those messages or those themes that tug at you, like that seeking recognition that I keep coming back to again and again. But yeah, I guess I always try to push that out of my mind as much as possible, at least in the early drafting.
We're going to take a short break here. You're listening to Book Central. Support for this program is provided by Plot Twist Bookstore in Ankeny, a place where book lovers can browse, talk, and meet. Open daily. For hours and more information, go to plottwistbookstore.com. We're back. If you're just joining me, my guest today is Dustin M. Hoffman, debut author of 100 Knuckled Fist. Before the break, we were talking about the parables of his stories and the escape from work into imagination. The great Southern and Central Time author from Alabama, Tom Franklin, wrote a story called Grit, set in a minerals processing plant where a worker blackmails his boss. And I was somewhat reminded of it while reading your story, Dustin, the one called Fire Chasers, except your story is about the guy who will wind up being the last guy at the factory, while everyone in town starts fires to get some money from insurance. Nowadays, it seems like there's not many working man writers. There used to be a lot from the South, some in the northeastern ports, many from the Midwest fields and factories more scattered throughout the frontiers of the timberland in the West and fishing in the Northwest. Does it feel like there are less tradespeople in writing? I mean, less writers, but also less characters who have trade jobs?
It does seem that way, and you know, and I wonder if it's my perception or if it is actually a trend happening. But I've talked to other friends, other writers about this, that it seemed like we used to have more people that were, you know, full-time carpenters. And I've mentioned this to you before. I think of Nick Lindsay in Studs Terkel Working.
Mm-hmm.
Who talks about being a poet and a carpenter, and I think we used to see that more historically, and it probably has something to do with the availability of creative writing programs in at universities and colleges, as well as, you know, all the MFAs that have popped up. Not to mention now that, you know, the MFA no longer has that terminalness with the PhDs, with creative writing emphasis. So, you know, there's so much, I think, available with classes and then, of course, like residencies and fellowships and workshops and everything that's happening online. So I think, you know, these days, if you, I don't know how many people are becoming writers on their own like there used to be, and that seems like a bit of a loss. I've also mentioned to you before Donald Ray Pollock, one of my favorite contemporary authors, and he worked in, I think, foundries.
I think that he was a dump truck driver driving like ash back and forth.
Oh, wow.
at a foundry. I think it was in Ohio. I know that he blurbed your book, so definitely, you know, you respected him and he respected you. But yeah, what about Donald for you as a writer? I mean, he was a tradesperson.
Yeah, and I found when I discovered him in my MFA, and he was such an important voice for me. And his characters are—they don't always work. In fact, they're often out of work. but he had that sensibility that I was looking for. I think that spoke to the world I came from, the working world. And you know, he came to writing late. I think in his 40s, maybe he started, and or maybe even a little bit later, but. You know, having worked his entire life at a very blue-collar job. And I think that's important for his perspective, what he brings to his characters. Not to say that, you certainly, other writers can do the research and get these stories right. But you know, I'm slightly concerned. I worry about it. I often tell my students, and I teach undergrads primarily now, and they talk about MFA programs and, you know, taking a little bit of time in between and what should they do?
Get a job.
And yeah, I tell them that. Yeah, go work a really crappy job and you'll get such good stories out of it. You'll have characters and you'll want to write so much more. But, you know, I think that gets a little devalued and, of course, it's tough, you know. I would rather travel to Europe than than go work at McDonald's.
Right. Right. Yeah.
Although I think both may be, you know, as inspiring for fiction, even though working at McDonald's does not seem that way.
And, you know, you could be a student forever. And I guess the problem is that if you're just constantly writing about being a writer or being in the academy, that doesn't reflect everybody's experience, that we're not having stories that are able to be told for the tradespeople, about the tradespeople.
Yeah. Yeah. And I often tell my students, too, that it's hard to care about a character until I know how they make a living, like what job they do. And if they don't have a job, then I really struggle to believe a character at all. And the work is so fascinating. I think we forget about that that coming to fiction as escapism. Although now I think the jobs might be kind of escapism ever since the recession and so many people lost their jobs. I think that we've been looking to work and maybe a little more interested in what people do and the jobs that survive and the jobs that went extinct.
What do you maybe do defines who you are? And if you don't do anything, are you anybody?
Yeah, it's tough. And that shows up in the collection a bit, too. Characters struggling with not having work.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been there too. I think, so I'll do one of my favorite quotes, I have an Orwell quote in the beginning of the book. That's one of my favorites, but, from, Joseph Conrad in Heart of Darkness, Marlowe at one point in the middle of the book says, "I don't like work. No man does, but I like what is in the work, the chance to find yourself, your own reality for yourself, not for others, what no other man can ever know. They can only see the mere show and never can tell what it really means." I always love that quote, even though I never have been sure if Conrad was thinking Marlowe was kind of full of it when he was saying this stuff, because in fact, like the frame narrators get upset at him a little bit later in this, Marlowe for ranting about work and such. But
work,
anyway, you know.
But work gives you some responsibility. I mean, I came across Rebecca Solnit, who's this critic, and she was saying, it was wonderful. Carpenters don't say, "I'm just not feeling it today," or "I don't give a damn about this staircase and whether people fall through it." And how you feel is something that you cannot take too seriously on your way to doing something. And doing something is a means of not being stuck in how you feel. So it's this weird paradox of when you have a job, you have a responsibility, and you have a responsibility to your job. And hopefully that's something you can give to your students or just people who want to be writers, is you have a responsibility to write, and you have a responsibility to craft this world, build this world, to make it an inhabitable place, a built place.
Yeah. Yeah. Hell yeah. A sense of responsibility to go with writing. Although I think I have known tradesmen who have hit points of not caring about the staircase.
Sure.
They're working.
Sure. Sure.
But you know that, and I think there is a lot of like feeling in the responsibility too. That is quite a pressing tension, which is fiction gold, you know, all of that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Confronting the responsibility that you're forced into.
And people say working man. I mean, we even kind of, you know, are talking about working men because we probably knew a lot of men, but really it's tradespeople, women too. In your book, there are a few notable working women. In one story, Conk Tongue, you took a big risk, or I thought you took a big risk, and wrote in the first person point of view of a woman, not only a woman, but a black woman, and not even an American, but a Jamaican. In the story, this woman, who's a tour guide, must showcase paradise to a couple who only go by their last name, Truman. And these Trumans own Soul Matrix, a dating website that might send honeymooners to Sunnyside Hotel, the employer of this working woman. Did you feel like you had to showcase your ability to write as another gender, another race?
Well, and this story came into the collection actually a little bit late, and I tried to never approach like feeling a character quota or a point of view quota or any of that. I mean, you know, I think about it somewhat, but you know, the art kind of, or the book demands what it demands, and it wanted this story eventually, but I never was feeling like I needed this voice or a different gender. Necessarily, it was more like the themes were right, the work was right for what this book was doing, and you know, that was a tough story to write. Conk Tongue, I think I probably did more research for that story than any other one. Of course, I'd had tons of firsthand research with the construction type stories.
Mm-hmm.
And the Conk Tongue kind of stemmed originally from a world languages linguistics class I was taking in my PhD, and so we were studying different world English dialects, and I kind of went down a rabbit hole of studying Jamaican patois and got obsessed with this, and that story has kind of like multiple levels of repressed Jamaican patois and characters that embrace it more, and which I think speaks to like class and working classes much. And you know, it's a fascinating, I mean, we have that in America too, certainly people who are fighting their own regional dialects down south.
Mm-hmm.
Some of my students have told me that they try to turn off their southern drawl, because you know, they worry people will question their intelligence. I don't think that's everybody, but you know, fascinating way that how we speak can class us, and like the fear of that has been fascinating to me. But you mentioned taking a risk, and I've talked to you about this before too.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel like so much of a risk. I mean, of course, late I think about that with readers, perhaps. But I've written a lot of women narrators, and I'm working on a novel now that has primarily a female narrator. But those voices have always seemed very natural to me. I was raised in a house full of women, and I live in a house full of strong women now. All my friends have pretty much always been women. Besides working construction, which even then there was some great women colleagues I had, but you know, I guess that's a voice I in some ways feel more comfortable writing in. And when it comes down to it, as well, I'm probably not thinking about the differences and how a woman differs from a man so much as thinking about the character. You know, it comes up in workshop.
Sure.
Every time when a woman is writing a man or a man is writing a woman, there's often that question comes up of, does this sound right? Does this sound authentic?
Or is it appropriation?
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I think these are good concerns to have, but when it comes down to it, I mean, if you're doing your research and, you know, really empathizing with the characters you write, you know, I think it's you're writing humans when it comes down to it, and that's how I've always felt. But then again, maybe I'm writing my sisters and my mom, and and those voices have always stayed with me.
And on the flip side of that, I mean, maybe we don't ask whether or not people should be writing about jobs that they haven't worked. Like, what do writers do who aren't tradespeople? What do they do that they get wrong when they attempt to write a character as a laborer?
Yeah, it's, you know, for me, it's the tools. As soon as the verbs, as soon as a writer has mislabeled a tool or a terminology for doing something, I'm done. My suspension of disbelief is broken. So you know, these little details, I think, are so important. There's an old joke we used to have. The old carpenter joke. I wonder if you ever heard this one. Was you tell the new guy to go find the board stretcher?
Oh yes, I have heard that.
Yeah, so you know, you see the new guy wandering around the house asking the drywallers, uh-huh, like, "Have you seen the board stretcher, man?"
And it's like going snipe hunting, you know, for the invisible bird or whatever.
Yeah,
it doesn't exist.
Exactly.
But there is such a beautiful language in construction. I mean, I never would have known that a wall is called a frame, but the frame, if you want to call it, that you put on the ground that you pour concrete into is called the form. And it's so you don't get those words confused. But how beautiful is that? That you frame a wall and that you create a form for concrete to pour into. Yeah, there's just so much beautiful language that why would you want to get it wrong?
Yeah. And, you know, that's also the beauty of getting it right is that you have this kind of this new vocabulary, or I tell my students often, like, go find that poetry of work. And every job has it in its tools and the stuff of the work and the jargon. And I love that stuff. But you get it wrong, and I think, you know, immediately a carpenter would notice. I was a... last minute with the book, I was in proofing stages. I thought I might have something wrong with some terminology around a roofing story in there. And I called some roofers, and they're very kind in getting the terminology right. I had it wrong, but it got fixed before the book came out. I'm so grateful. And that's something, you know, a copy editor, and I had some great ones at the press, but, you know, they're probably not going to catch something like that. So, but, you know, one of the most important things to me, I think, is getting those details right.
We're going to take another short break here. You're listening to Book Central. This program is supported by Humanities Iowa and the National Endowment for the Humanities. The views and opinions expressed by this program do not necessarily reflect those of Humanities Iowa or the National Endowment for the Humanities. We're back with my guest, Dustin M. Hoffman, who worked for 10 years painting houses. His debut book of working class stories is 100 Knuckled Fist. We've been talking about the loss of tradespeople in fiction and the responsibility of writing outside your gender, race, and job. Dustin, in your first published story, Pushing the Knives, a newbie salesman recognizes a fellow worker by his orange reflective vest over a black t-shirt, asphalt-splotched jeans, a road paver, probably a city worker, the guy who blurs past his car window at the side of the road on his way to work. I'm sure you still see guys who, you know, do labor, but do you ever wonder if they see you? Do they know who you were? Do they know who you are?
That's a fun question. I mean, I see them everywhere, and probably because I'm so fascinated in their stories that they're often so inspiring. I wonder what that job is like to work. I was just recently at a kids fair, and I was thinking about one of the workers that monitor the bouncy castles.
Oh yeah.
But you know, I was and my kid is like jumping, having a great time. My 3-year-old couldn't be cuter inside this bouncy castle, and I'm kind of like spying on this
man in overalls.
and it was a woman who looked like she'd been doing this job forever. She was so good at corralling the kids, but kind of being forceful too. I'm thinking of like, what is the art of, you know, being kind yet, you know, shrewd enough to like to control the bouncy castle. What's it like to blow these things up? And all that was is so fascinating. So yeah, I'm always aware of them, and also trying to always say thank you, which I think we could probably do more of, you know, the people sweeping up around us, and to recognize them as much as possible. But do they see me? I wish they did. And I have to guess that probably not. I talked to my friend about this, who is a veteran and writes about war a great deal and his military service. Brandon Davis Jennings is a fantastic new author. You know, we talk about, you know, is he writing for veterans? Am I writing for a readership of working class readers? You know, probably not. And sadly, although, you know, who's picking up a short story collection is probably often not working class folks. But I hope, you know, I hope I got it right, and that's one of the most important things to me. And I hope some of them feel like the voices are right, the stories are right for this world that definitely needs to be portrayed and brought more to the surface.
And gratitude, that's a really interesting thing to point out, is that lots of these people are invisible. That's your opening to the book, is the epigraph from Orwell, is that people who work with their hands are invisible. And there's a responsibility to make these people visible so we see them. So it's curious and also a good responsibility to have to look at these people who have jobs, who do things that make our world, and then write about them.
Yeah, for sure. I think of, like Amy Poehler a few years back was thanking the woman who takes care of her children, and, you know, just giving, just being more appreciative and recognizing the folks that do these really hard jobs is important. And, you know, I don't know, you know, how many. I try to be honest with this collection too, and there's certainly workers not looking great in a lot of places too. But you know, this is to me an ode to the people I love that I work with, and you know, I hope it is seen that way.
And along with a good nature of gratitude, you seem to have some good fun with naming. Not just characters' names. I'm thinking about like George Saunders' daughter supplied names. Like he would say, "I need a name, male," and his daughter would say, "Fred Lank," and it'd be believable. But for you, it's workplaces and products. For instance, in Pushing the Knives, that first short story of yours, you have this company called Thunder Blades, and it reminded me of Tarantino's Big Kahuna Burgers in Pulp Fiction. Even your names do work.
Yeah, I have a lot of fun with that. And that is a part of this world so much, is the brand name products. I was talking to somebody a while ago. I was asked to say a favorite word or phrase, and sheetrock was on my mind. and they came back and said, oh, that, you know, that's a company name, you realize. And,
oh.
And I didn't, because it was so, it's so common. You think, you know, if you're doing drywall, it's, you say, you know, it's sheetrock.
It's like the Kleenex of construction or something.
Yeah, it is the dumpster, you know, the styrofoam.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out it is a proper noun. But, and what a beautiful, really some ad guy or whatever came up with a beautiful name that has this like smooth sound and this hard rock end to it. It's, you know, it's a beautiful word, really.
It's better than drywall.
And then I feel bad that, you know, some like some suit and a chair, I'm giving him props for coming up with a good term. But, you know, that's, he deserves it, I suppose. A lot of these were a fun adventure for me, often a break to come up with these fun names. My wife came, and she deserves credit. She came up with Baba in the Black, the name of one of the self-help conferences for the shepherd, and kind of one of the more surreal or absurdist stories in there. And we went back and forth on a lot of these, trying to come up with goofy conference names or brand name products. And that's kind of a fun, you can workshop that with other people, especially like your jokes, trying out your jokes. It's so, you know, I think that's important to test them a little bit, because who the hell knows what's funny?
After reading another short story, this is kind of about uniforms, because I was asking you about whether or not the working man tradespeople saw you, and you definitely see them. I didn't believe the aphorism clothes make the man after reading Everything a Snake Needs, because there's this one character named Drew, this college guy, but a new employee who breaks the rules and handles snakes at Rizzo's Reptile Emporium. This guy Drew dresses up with a professorial elbow padded jacket, but he doesn't know anymore about snakes because of what he wears. I came to believe that uniforms, clothes that are worked in, identify a person as a tradesperson. And I assume you don't have any of your old painter's whites anymore, but do you ever wish you still had them to slip back into and blend in?
And I do. I have one set of painter whites left, stashed somewhere in some Tupperware box or something like that. But I don't know why I'm holding on to it. If it's sentimental, or if I think, like, you know, they might fire me, and I can always go back to painting, or, you know, if I lose my teaching job. But I still have them around, and maybe as a reminder of how much smaller I was and in better shape, or maybe as a reminder of the work that I did. I think, you know, the painter whites especially were such an interesting uniform that we are, you know, hiding our flaws, because mostly painters are working in some off-white or caulk, hides well on the painter whites, so it looks like you don't make as many mistakes if you're wearing this appropriate uniform. I mean, that's just kind of, that was always a fascinating detail to me about that work. And now I suppose I'm a little like Drew. I'm always wearing the uniform. When I teach in a tie, for the most part, I try to look as nice as I can. Partly, you know, it's to honor my students a little bit, or to show them I'm taking this very seriously. But I think also I feel like I've earned it a little bit. I've escaped from my painter whites. And, you know, a lot of my colleagues don't dress up as much. And that's fine. That's, in fact, I think they probably look a little better and maybe get a little more respect from their students. But for me, it's like, I earned this uniform in a way. I want to wear this uniform. So It's an important one for me.
It's almost like when you put on the uniform, you can become the person.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. It gives you confidence. You know, a brand new set of painter whites did that for me too on the job. You feel good. You feel like you're going to make less mistakes when you're wearing those fresh painter whites that aren't marked up already.
So there's another story, one more for you, where Franco Sims, this painter who came out of his mother on a ladder with a brush in his hand, zips along next to a young green painter, someone with a year or so under his brush. And Sims is this talker who tells all these stories, but all without anyone having to face consequences. I read this story as an origin story of sorts, or maybe it should be better to call it a primer story. Not necessarily that you worked with a guy named Sims, but that through this character, you're demanding risk. What makes a good story for you as a reader, as a writer, as a teacher?
That's a good question. What makes a good story? I mean, tension being concerned, yet language is what it comes down to most of all. Humor is so important to me, but you know, it has to break that at some point. Humor is that gateway emotion for me that will make me cry later. Mm-hmm. But if you don't go for the tears, like George Saunders and Vonnegut are so good at this, you know, they make you laugh first and then they break your heart, mm-hmm. do it so beautifully. And you know, it's funny you bring up that story, because I think of that story as, kind of metafictional in some ways or speaking to the creations of stories, which is what we were often doing at work, is telling each other stories to make it through the, mm-hmm. the 12-hour days standing on a ladder. But you know, in that story, the narrator is struggling with the purpose of the story, the shape of a story, and how this speaks to one's trade. And I think, you know, I was trying to figure that out before I even was thinking about a writer, like how we trade stories and how that represents you. And I can't stop thinking about that as well. So I think that's important too in some ways, and maybe because I like the postmodernists so much, a good story for me often makes me think about the art of creating story. I want to be kind of shaken out of my suspension of disbelief a little bit in some ways, to be thinking about how this thing was made.
And maybe that character should face consequences. It seems like Sims just has all this risk that deflates itself, and then the story, almost like this Ars Poetica, this purpose of writing, is that someone's got to have something bad happen.
Yeah, I think that's where really a story really lives, is in a characters making mistakes, but then if they don't face the consequences, you don't have a story yet, and that story kind of forces some consequence to happen, or the narrator kind of forces it. I mean, that's essential too. That's how we find out what a character is made of. And something Vonnegut says in his rules of writing is to love your characters, but to torture them to see what they're made of. Yeah.
And since we're talking about structure of stories, or just about stories, one of only two unpublished stories in your collection is this one called We Ride Back. It loosely connects to Sawdust and Glue. I don't know of the circumstances of that story, if it was a section of stories that might have made up a novel and you separated it, or it was a longer portion of Sawdust and Glue that you removed. But I wondered, when I read it, when do you know a story is done? I mean, is it ever done? Do you just always have to renovate stories?
Yeah, a question I don't know if I'll ever know the answer to, and it's such a struggle to find your endings. I often am circling them for the longest time. That's part of what I love about publication. One of my favorite things about it is somebody agreeing with me that yes, this is the end to a story, you can call that done. Although then, you know, I'm revisiting those stories again once I was putting it into the book. So a magazine had published them and said it was done, but now I have a chance to rethink that a bit more. And I think every writer has that instinct of wanting to find the better ending. there's a story of Charles Baxter, one of my friends told when he came and did a reading at their school, and he was, while he was reading from one of his collections, he was writing all over the book, and they asked him afterward what he was doing, and he said he was revising. And so, you know, even somebody like Charles Baxter, as there's that constant instinct to try to find the best version of that story. So I don't know. When is the story done? Who knows? And I was surprised that We Ride Back kind of referenced the characters in Sawdust and Glue, and they were always separate stories. But I think those themes and those characters kind of creep back into things and want a little bit more. And maybe that's a great joy in writing too, in that you find some of those characters and some of those arcs and some of those themes that just have to keep being written in different ways.
Well, it's that same world, you know, that subdivision construction world that you would assume there are tradespeople who cross paths, that they get to know people either by sight or by name or by quality of work that they're working next to them. In We Ride Back, a group of thieves robs the work sites of housing developments for tools. These are some of your workers who aren't working. At first, the story follows a first-person plural point of view, the we in We Ride Back, but then it splits into first-person singular when a guy who becomes the story's narrator runs for it as the cops are called and the getaway van is packed with stolen stuff and the crew of thieves is escaping without the narrator. I was reminded a bit of John Cheever's story, The Swimmer, about a guy who swims his way home through a state's pools, but your guy runs through subdivisions, backyards. How do you decide the closeness you will write your characters, outside of them in third person or inside of them as first person or second person? You've talked about how you really appreciate postmodern writers. I wonder if that has any influence about pulling some tricks in crafting stories.
Yeah. And point of view is one of the most fascinating things to me, one of the most fun tools for us to play with. So We Ride Back is in that first-person communal or the we narrator, and I'm so obsessed with we stories. I think there are four of them in the collection, and in that one, the individual I emerges, but in the three other ones, I think they stick with we, and no individual narrator pops up. And that, to me, was that we narrator feels so organic to the work story. I think when we come home and we tell the story of what happened at work, it often starts with, you know, we were doing this, the kitchen was getting really busy in the back, and we were hustling, and a bunch of customers came in, and it's this group of working together until John dropped the plate of dishes, and
that guy singled out.
Yeah. And there's like an organic tension in that when the I separates from the we. So it's really fun for me to play with that. Not to mention it has that kind of Greek chorus feel to it. It's a little bit haunting, and it speaks to the invisibility of working people too, that, you know, you're fighting for, you want to be a part of the group, but you're also seeking that identity and individual recognition. This is probably too much theory to give to the we that I've often found is just kind of a magic point of view, or I have so much fun writing in it. I love writers that experiment with it too. I have to be so close to my characters too, if not in first person. I really love a close third that almost reads like as voiced as a first person. One of my mentors, Jamie Gordon, her National Book Award winning novel was Lord of Misrule, and I think she does close third better than maybe anybody has. Those characters sound so voiced in those third narrations.
And other than voice, you know, setting takes a really big focus in the collection. But the other story that was unpublished from the collection is a medieval set, modern voiced, but it's a piece called Shepherd's Work, and we talked a little bit about it before. But specifically, on one hand, it's fantasy landscape contrasts with the subdivisions of most of the other stories in the collection, but it's also about work. I didn't know, do you think your story Shepherd's Work was too odd for editors on its own? And how did you see the story fitting together with the other trade stories of your collection? And why set it in a fantasy world?
So all great questions. And it was one of the last stories, or one of the most recent stories I wrote. And so it didn't get circulated around the magazine world too much. And I got a couple good, nice rejections on it. And then I eventually pulled it when the collection was coming out. So there could be some new material in it. So maybe that's my protective hope that that some editor would have taken it. Mm-hmm. And perhaps. But it's a weird story. And I like it for that. And I wanted it to be in the collection for, you know, it hits those themes. And it is still characters seeking recognition in so many ways, but the world is very different. The work is very different. And that's important for me in a short story collection. You know, it all needs to feel collected like one work, but I get short story fatigue even with writers I really admire and love. You know, when you hit that 12th story in the collection and you know their tricks and you know their patterns and you're seeing things too clearly. So I really wanted to take things out of the subdivision, out of this kind of construction world, and make sure there were a couple big changes in there. And, you know, the fantasy world, and there's a couple kind of fantastic stories in the collection. I think that speaks to the working world, which is, you know, sometimes what we do gets us to this level of absurdity and surrealism with mm-hmm. just the monotony of all of this, of production, of going at it every day. There's a lot of weirdness to it. So I wanted a couple of those moves in the collection.
The stories in 100 Knuckled Fist chronicle the descent of the working man from unionized lifetime jobs at factories to specialized contractors with semi-regular work to general laborers with seasonal work to odd jobs here and there. And then the unemployed, those who don't work, can't find work or do other things besides legal work. Now you've got a PhD, highest degree in your field, you're a professor, and so I wondered about your reflections on the transition from the trade of painting to the craft of writing. I wondered about this transition as I read Workman's Compensation, a story that gives instructions on how to get out of work, but then the character, a second person you, longs to return to work. So what are some imperatives you would give a writer? What do you want writers to do? How should writers work?
I tell my students to never wait for the muse. If you sit around waiting for seeking inspiration, it'll never come. You know, you have to approach writing. Well, and this is what's worked for me, and for so many writers, say this the same stuff. You know, apply ass to chair, that kind of philosophy. But I think, you know, to approach it like work is what I tell my students, like a job. Give yourself a schedule. Come at it for an hour at least every day, you know, that you keep coming back to this piece is so important so you can dive deep into it instead of just skimming along. And that's a bummer for some of my students to hear, I think, but so important. You know, you'll never find that one inspiring muse day if you haven't put in 9 horrible, difficult days. Too. And, you know, on the same side, I also don't really believe in writer's block. It's just a bad day of work, and everybody else in the world just has to face that. I think we do too. And it's true for almost all of us. I do think it is 9 bad days to get to 1 good day. But you have to put in the time to get there. It's that, I would say, my imperative to writers, and also to just read all the time, to read what fascinates you and what you're obsessed with, to read over your head, to read stuff you don't get, and to read stuff that makes you jealous. I think that's the other end of our work, really, is to read everything that we possibly can get our hands on.
Dustin, thank you so much for being on Book Central with me.
Thank you. It's been a great pleasure.
Dustin M. Hoffman is the author of 100 Knuckled Fist. Thank you for listening to Book Central. I'm your host, Chris Viviora. Our theme music was composed by Will Pett.